8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Here and There, audio postcards from Earth on Tuesday, October 9th from 7 to 9 p.m. at OMSI in Portland.
Here and There, audio postcards from Earth is an all ages and ability inclusive.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Hopworks Urban Brewery, offering sustainable brews and local food for 10 years, serving the community at three locations: Hopworks Urban Brewery on Southeast Powell Boulevard, Bike Bar at North Williams Avenue, and in Vancouver on Southeast Mill Plain Boulevard. More information online at hopworksbeer.com.
I'm Suzanne LeGrand, and today on Between the Covers, my guests are Rosemary Lombard and Beth Lyons, contributing writers to Writing for Animals. Welcome. Everyone is aware of the ways in which animals are mistreated in society. Through the efforts of some writers, we are also becoming more aware of animals' different intelligences, creativities, and capacities for feeling, qualities that we tend to reserve for humans. Writing for Animals, a new anthology published by Ashland Creek Press, is somewhat unusual. It is not about animals per se, but about how writers shape our understandings of animals through the stories they tell about them. Aimed at writers and instructors, this anthology looks at the ways writers portray animals, often as devices to tell human stories, and explores how writers may write more realistically and respectfully on animals' behalf. One of my guests today is Rosemary Lombard, an animal behaviorist, cognitive psychologist, writer, poet, and contributor to this anthology. Welcome.
Thank you, Suzanne.
In your essay, A Case for More Reality in Writing About Animals, you talk about the long history of anthropomorphism, or using animals as devices for telling human stories, starting with the tale we all know, Goldilocks. Mm-hmm. To start, could you tell me what's wrong with using animals as a stand-in for human characters and qualities in stories?
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's wrong in itself. There are social reasons that animals can stand in for stories. Think about someone who's writing a children's book who doesn't want to count how many of every race there is in the story, because we're getting those sensitivities. But if we want to use the animals to for their benefit, and that's what the publisher means by for animals, that is, for the benefit of animals, advocacy, then we have to approach it from a different point of view, which is to say we need to grow the respect, the love that are prerequisite to our wanting to do something about the problems that we have, that animals have, in the history of animals and people.
How can writers build this respect and love for animals in the way that they write, in your opinion?
A little tricky, and that depends on how you're using the animal in the story. There are animal stories that emphasize, say, the ferocity of an animal. That's not helpful, except in the sense that, yes, we have to be careful of animals that are dangerous to us. But there are other sides. If you have a story about the life of the animal that has enough reality in it that you recognize it as itself, not just some blob with four legs, and the individual individuality of each animal as well as the individuality of each subspecies, each species, et cetera, all the way back. But using one thing is using a great language, choosing your language for respect. I have a poem that, knowing a turtle very well for decades, leads to me say, just think, if she were going to say this, she would say, "Don't call me an it.
Mm-hmm.
I am a she."
Interesting. And that's the point of many of the essays in mm-hmm. the anthology mm-hmm. is about how to transform perceptions from mm-hmm. objects to be used to mm-hmm. subjectivities to be in relationship mm-hmm. with.
If right. We have a problematic history about that. Back in the 17th century, Descartes, in the throes of the Enlightenment, was treating animals as automatons. And that lasted so long, even through the behaviorists into the 20th century. So it's been a slow change into respecting animals' individuality and what they can do, as you say, in intelligence. And that makes a difference.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I study turtle intelligence and what the potential of their cognition is with really amazing accomplishments that they have if they're given their space to do it and enough power. So those things and the way even tiny, tiny-brained animals can plan and be very flexible. For instance, jumping spiders, which you would hardly expect from the size of the brain, which is turns out not to be such a big deal after all.
I'd like to bring Beth Lyons into the conversation. Beth is the author of 3 fantasy novels and 3 science fiction novellas. And in her essay, Real Advocacy Within Fantasy Worlds, she raises an interesting question. She raises the question of how, as a vegan writer, do animals eat? Quote, can the hero of your novel hunt animals for food, or is that reserved solely for villains? So let me ask you, Beth, why is it important for writers to think seriously about things like food or how animals are used in a fictional world?
Yes, well, first of all, thanks so much for having me here. I'm excited. And certainly from my field of mostly fantasy and sci-fi genre, food and the procurement of it, the cooking of it, you think George Martin, I mean, you know, the Game of Thrones is just completely one feast after another. And so you can use, as a writer, you can use, you know, food, what people are eating, what people aren't eating, or at all, maybe, to denote, you know, class, their status, those various things. And so I realized that for, normally you'd say like, oh, well, rich people eat just tons of meat, you know, just big carcasses everywhere. And I realized like, well, it doesn't have to be that way, but that's such a huge shift for, you know, the reading populace in general, that I wanted to make sure there's a reason, a good grounded reason why you would have people who perhaps ate completely a vegan sort of a diet within that fantasy world. How is that going to look and not be just so jarring, both to the people within the story as well as the actual readers who are reading it?
Mm-hmm. And as you wrote about fiction, you said that fiction introduces unfamiliar and even controversial subjects to readers. You say that stories are real world magic with the power to change hearts and everyday stories that consider more than humans and their needs. And so I'm wondering, how do you see fiction as potentially changing our understandings about animals in the real world?
That's a great question. Well, certainly to an extent, I mean, we're all others to each other. I don't know exactly, you know, all the things that go on in your brain. And animals are just another extension of that. They're a more difficult to comprehend other. And so I feel like, you know, perhaps say like using an alien in a short story or novel or whatever, it's like that alien can stand in for an animal, and it's something that's familiar to a reader to be like, oh, right, okay, so this alien maybe looks like a simian or something, but it's an alien. It's not really a monkey. But then as you start to maybe introduce the concepts of, say, slavery or imprisonment or animal testing or something like that in within this framework of this alien species, you can have those themes and almost like begin that discussion, but it's safe because it's not about what me as a human being has done and whether I agree or disagree with, say, like animal testing or something like that. But it allows that reader to perhaps have a window, maybe not a door, but a window into a different way of thinking and mm-hmm. conceiving what this other might look like.
Mm-hmm. So how is writing about animals different than or similar to writing about human characters? And maybe either one of you could answer this question. It seems to me that there are some interesting ethical as well as creative problems when you think about writing about and for those who don't use human language.
Mm-hmm. And that's the big problem. We rely so much in our fiction on dialogue, and we don't have that direct a connection with dialogue with animals. So there are a number of ways around that. First of all, getting a very good understanding of that species, and there are lots of clues for doing the research in the book, which I think we won't go into at this point. But if we have an accurate idea, or even in poetry and fantasy, have enough of the sense of the reality by knowing those certain details that denote the animal behind it, then we have a beginning.
Yeah, I think to kind of go on top of that, to say, for me, it's about you want the language to ring true. So it's rare for me to ever like give a voice to an animal or anything like that so far in my writing. But you know, it's like the voice of those characters is so important. Mm-hmm. And so you think like, well, what kind of how would a turtle speak? Is it mm-hmm. cliche to think that a turtle would be low and kind of measured in how they speak and thoughtful? Mm-hmm. Maybe you have a weird turtle who like thinks like lightning fast, and that's mm-hmm. just, you know, she walks slow and thinks mm-hmm. fast. Mm-hmm. And so that to me would matter very much, to think like you want to pay the right sort of homage to what those characters are actually doing based on their physiology.
Mm-hmm. 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 It's interesting that the title of the anthology is Writing for Animals. Mm-hmm. And so the idea in this anthology is that you are writing on behalf of, or in some sense, you are the voice for animals. Mm-hmm. That raises an interesting question about how you speak on behalf of animals in a way that is respectful of them. Rosemary has published a book of poems called Turtles All the Way, in which you actually speak in their voices.
Yes, and that's one of the techniques that's possible, the persona poem. For instance, I have the example of a tortoise who was imported, probably illegally, from Kenya. And I knew something of the way that black market worked and the terrible effects it has on populations, turtles and frogs. And the rarest of the rare are the ones that they pick up, and populations are just going down and down and down toward extinction in many, many species. So I knew enough about how that happened and what the issues were, and I knew what happened to this particular tortoise at the end, how he was sold from a pet store, and then the boy brought him back to a herpetological society, and he ended up with me. And I was able then to have something of a sense of how to do this poem. And I did it in a way that, in this case, it was pretty raw, because it's a horrible situation. And I was very intense about doing something. This is the way I can do something about changing that whole huge business. A very small part, to be sure. The first time I read it to a group, they all looked as if I'd been throwing cold, wet fish in their face. And maybe that was good, maybe that wasn't good. But persona is one way to do it, or you can have animals speak. You can interpret them, translate them into what you think they mean, and so on.
How do you do that in a way that you have some sense that it is either accurate or respectful?
You do have to know the animal, hopefully to the individual level. And we can't all go on safaris and spend 20 years studying, say, an elephant, as some people have,
and
but
you,
they have.
You've also spent 30 years studying turtles.
I have. More than that, if you could start counting. So I feel fairly confident about their responses, and they have developed different ways to communicate.
And both of you talk a lot about language, mm-hmm. and the resource that writers have to actually change our perceptions through the way that we describe and talk about animals in stories. It's interesting that, and I think you mentioned this, Beth, that there are many unconscious ways in which we use language, for example, common idioms. Such as counting chickens before they hatch, beached like a whale, mm-hmm. killing two birds with one stone, don't be a chicken, which reinforce negative and inaccurate portrayals of animals. And you propose that writers change the language we use to describe and talk about animals. And
yes.
I'm wondering, what does that look like?
Yeah, that's a... It's, for me, exactly what writing for animals, for me, is about, that sense of being able to do advocacy through it. And I realized, especially writing fantasy, so often high fantasy in particular, you know, you're riding horses, you're wearing leather, you know, farmers are, you know, the poor farmers are using oxen to plow. And I realized that those things don't have to be. Those are just, you know, kind of tired tropes in many ways. And as I was really working on the first novel, and now it's just become almost second nature, I realized I wanted to both kind of inject the story with some nice little like fantasy flavorings that is unique to this world of Serana, where the fantasy novelist sat. And to do that, I needed to turn those sorts of idiomatic expressions on their head. So yeah, it was really fun. I think one of them is something like apple blossoms don't bake a pie, which, you know, I was really happy with that one. And there's a couple other ones like that, you know, and you figure like, and the best thing, in my opinion, at least for fiction, is I don't want the reader to necessarily even be conscious of that. I say in the essay that the best compliment I've gotten about my writing is that nobody is like, oh my God, it's all vegan. You know, it's like they're reading, they're here for the story. And if I can give them something on kind of a subliminal level, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. Or if they can read it and realize that this main character doesn't eat any sort of animal products and think like, what would that look like for me? You know, that would be amazing.
So in some sense, then, fiction does translate to real life, at least in our imaginations.
Oh, yeah, I believe that completely as far as thinking about, you know, because they're all just stories. We're all human. We're trying to get along so and make our way in the world, whatever our hero's journey might be. And so, yeah, I feel like all of my fantasy is really grounded in reality.
One thing to add on that, there's a really good example that Mary Beth Holliman makes. She learned from, what was his name, Gordon Huber, who was a wolf researcher, the difference between the word pack and family. The connotation is tremendous. I'm not sure it, as she suggests, an aggregation of fighting beasts. And there was an adjective that was a strong visual adjective of the ferocity of the pack. But better, family, if you know about the family behaviors of the canines and wolves in particular, and the wolf family that you're talking about. And I'm seeing that in the newspaper, that they are talking about the wolves as families, which is good, but doesn't always say them.
I think this raises maybe the central purpose of writing for animals, which is that in changing thinking about animals and changing how we describe them, how we talk about them, there's a connection between that and perhaps changing our relationship to animals. And I think you
absolutely.
You speak to, to that, Rosemary. You you have this wonderful quote here by Stephen Jay Gould. He says, "We cannot win this battle to save species and environments without forging an emotional bond between ourselves and nature as well. But we will not fight to save what we do not love."
Right. And I agree with that wholeheartedly. Every organization that is working for the benefit of animals uses that in their programs to this. They have this named animal, and you can contribute for to adopt that animal. That contributes to that feeling.
I know, I'm thinking about, you know, it's Thanksgiving again almost, and I need to adopt my turkey. And of course, it's going to have a name and a story that tells you why this turkey deserves to be in this sanctuary. And something that you mentioned earlier, thinking of Descartes and that, that sense of animals as automatons, even though I don't have any novels yet that have like main characters as animals, just they're so often just in the background of a scene, either whether it's a dead carcass on a dining room table or it's a horse being ridden by somebody. And I wanted to avoid all of those things, or or when there are animals involved, that they're actually at the forefront. They're not automatons. Maybe they're not named, but they are individuals. Yeah, that's really important.
Too often animals are just devices within the plot.
Yes.
Or something to bring in conflict.
Be either a placeholder or, it's a mechanism to trigger, you know, the villain's anger about something. It's like there has to be more to it than that.
Or landscape, basically.
Yeah, that's just lazy writing.
One reason for a novel is that who wants to read pages of preachy dialogue about animal rights?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Going for the fiction side is going for story, pure story. And that's what people identify with most. That's why nonfiction people are going that direction.
And for me, it's tell a good story.
What would you like readers of this anthology to take away from the various, from your essays
Well, I hope a greater sensitivity to animals and their abilities and their individuality. And I hope beyond that to start thinking about their relationships with animals and what might change. And as writers, we just have an enormous power of change for advocacy in what we choose to write and how, you know, whether it's the language that does enhance that emotional contact or not.
And I think for me, the range of essays and the true like breadth of the experiences and the advice that come with the essay are just with the whole anthology are just amazing. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, there's me and several other fiction writers, but each of us are talking about a different sort of aspect of mm-hmm. that part of the craft. Mm-hmm. And then you've got mm-hmm. just some great essays besides Rosemary's, but other ones that are about, you know, creative nonfiction or even being, mm-hmm. you know, much more even scientific within the realm mm-hmm. of whatever you're writing. And mm-hmm. so I feel like it's a great book for students, teachers, or like a budding writer who is wondering, how can I be vegan mm-hmm. or even just an animal advocate and find a voice for my creativity?
Mm-hmm. I think it's useful for a wide range of readers, even for advocacy in humans.
Mm. Yes. Don't you think? That's true, yes.
Yes, because there are a lot of ideas and that's one of the strengths of having 13 authors. There's just a wide range of ideas and techniques and all sorts of details and many examples. For instance, there's a whole chapter about how Stephen King made a dog a compelling main character.
Yeah, I love that essay.
Yes, yes. And goes through the whole essay mm-hmm. And what his techniques were. And he's not the only one. He's most of the writers are citing particular books and particular stories and discussing them in some detail, which is just valuable for technique. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. One last question. I know that you emphasize accuracy, and a lot of the essays emphasize knowing animals really well in order to be able to write about them, but also for them. Mm-hmm. And so it raises an interesting question to me about what you see as the relationship between accuracy and empathy or even love.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think even in science fiction and fantasy, you have to have enough detail that's accurate so that the people can identify with that animal as the real animal, and if you have empathy for the fantasy animal, that reality aspect of it goes back to the real animal within our what we can do about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But so often we have versions of animals where there's a lot of emotion but not a lot of reality. So it's interesting mm-hmm. that this collection is really calling for a need to have an accurate view of animals in order to be able to speak mm-hmm. for them and also to have true mm-hmm. empathy.
Right. And the writer has to sense the empathy and have it come out in the story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes.
Or, conversely, the bad examples.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. As in Black Beauty, for instance.
Right.
I think even, to speak more on what Rosemary was saying, you're absolutely right. Even though it's a fantasy setting mm-hmm. and you're not expecting to close the book or power off your reader and walk outside and see a castle or anything like that, mm-hmm. you're still bringing part of that story with you. It's mm-hmm. it's part of your heart
right.
now.
Right.
And so if the animal's being portrayed, whether it's a boar or, you know, a horse or whatever it might be, and, mm-hmm. you know, in my mind, the reader has to be able to, you know, see a picture later of a pig or see a horse or whatever and be able to have that come to mind, that it's like, oh, yeah, this was very much like this story I just read.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. Today on Between the Covers, my guests have been Rosemary Lombard and Beth Lyons, contributors to Writing for Animals, an anthology to inspire and educate, published by Ashland Creek Press. I'm Suzanne LeGrand, and this is KBOO Portland.
Good morning, and welcome to Black Book Talk. I'm Patricia Welch, Librarian Emeritus.
And I'm Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman. Good morning.
And O.B. Hill, Reflections, Mirror Image Books.
And this is a What I'm Reading episode, and we are so pleased to have with us today from the Central Library of Multnomah County, the public Public Services Department. Mm-hmm. We have relatively new librarian Tamika Miles, who hails from Detroit.